Chapter 10. Dave was startled awake from an all-too-brief nap by Jesse shaking his shoulder excitedly.
"Part of the battle group is back. A destroyer just jumped in to recon the assembly zone. It'll jump back out soon to give the all-clear. Then the task force will be here," he announced with a gleeful shout.
"Come on, man. You don't want to miss this. I was watching it on the display in the briefing room, and one of the hamster kids there said he noticed battle damage to that destroyer."
"I'm on it."
Dave rubbed sleep from his eyes, now fully awake, swinging his feet down onto the deck. He knew there wasn't anything he could see on the display in the briefing room that he couldn't view on his Z-phone or the display built into the bulkhead of their tiny bunk room, but being with people made everything seem so much more real. When he got to the briefing room, Jesse was disappointed to see the big display on the opposite bulkhead was showing only their ship and a blinking ring off to the side. He couldn't tell how far they were from whatever the blinking ring was, because the display didn't include any sort of distance scale. Captain Strebitch was seated in front, and Captain Bonsu was strapping in beside her.
"What happened, man?" Dave asked, also disappointed.
"Where'd that destroyer go?"
"Where are the hamsters?"
Jesse asked, with a glance back over his shoulder through the open door.
"The destroyer jumped away. You just missed it," Irene answered.
"That ring," she pointed to the display, "represents the spatial distortion effect of their outbound jump.
You can't see it. That's a projection by the display.
She also checked the doorway.
"Hamster kids bugged out of here when too many humans came in here."
She emphasized her words with a single finger gesture that was not befitting an officer.
"Damn," she winked. "I hate it when it does that," she remarked while shaking her hand.
"That was quick."
Dave shrugged towards Jesse.
"The destroyer just got here."
"The destroyer was just performing a recon jump to assure the task force that the AZ is clear. They had to wait for their sensors to reset after coming through the jump, and they had to wait for distortion of the inbound jump to stop vibrating spacetime so they could form an outbound jump wormhole," she explained. "They were able to jump back early because the toaster," she gestured to the deck to indicate she was referring to the ship, "gave them the all-clear. Usual procedure would require the destroyer to sweep a bubble 5 light minutes in every direction before they okayed the task force to jump into the AZ.
"When will the task force be jumping here?"
Perkins asked as she strode into the briefing room, coming forward to take one of the seats in the front row and slipping a safety strap loosely around her waist.
"ASAP, if they follow standard procedure, ma'am," Derek responded. "Every second they wait, the gamma rays of that destroyer's inbound and outbound jumps are expanding outward and illuminating the AZ to enemy ships like shining a strobe light. The task force needs to get here, reset their sensors and shields, and maneuver into a defensive formation before an enemy can pinpoint the AZ and react. The hardest thing to remember about the rules of space combat is that ships can travel much faster than sensor data. If a ship sends out detectable energy, like an active sensor pulse or gamma rays, the enemy can pick up that energy and jump right on top of you before your sensor pulse returns to you."
Perkins nodded silently, because she had been learning space combat tactics in her own training.
"I told the Ruhar that I would be slow to learn about space combat because I'm not a pilot, and my instructor told me that is not a problem. Their opinion is the humans best able to transition to space combat would be our submarine commanders."
"Subs?" Jesse asked.
"Like, underwater, man?"
"I can see that,"
Dave mused, with a hand rubbing his chin in deep thought.
"Huh?"
Jesse looked at his friend in puzzlement.
"Think about it, Pone. Subdrivers have to rely on stealth. They can't go pinging the ocean with sonar or they give away their position."
"Correct,"
Perkins nodded happily. "A submarine crew is also used to relying on passive sensor data of an enemy they won't ever see, and they spend months at sea in a metal tube without ever seeing the sun."
"I've seen plenty of suns on this cruise,"
Jesse shook his head.
"But it's different looking at a star through a helmet visor when your feet aren't on solid ground, or any ground at all."
He was interrupted by Irene's excited shout. "Two ships just jumped in. Correction, one ship just jumped in. The other jumped in almost a minute ago, but it's 57 light seconds away, so we're just seeing it now."
Irene fiddled with the controls built into the arm of her chair, zooming in the image to show the closest warship,
a destroyer. That doesn't look good.
The ship had a long gouge out of its belly, with the scar wrapping around to the starboard side. Sparks flared from the damage area, and the destroyer's nose was flattened and smashed in. It was more difficult to detect if the second ship was damaged because it was farther away and the bulkhead display only had access to low-level sensors.
"Ma'am," Irene turned to Perkins, "you have access to command systems?"
"Limited access," Perkins grimaced.
The access that had been granted to her was only for training purposes. She didn't know if it would provide any real-time tactical data. To her surprise, she was able to pull up a status summary on her tablet, though the system wouldn't let her feed the info to the bulkhead display so her team could view it.
"You're right, Strebitz, this is not good. The Ruhar got into a battle against the Wargalin. Our friends thought they had the upper hand. Then the Boss Farrakh stepped in, and the Ruhar had to bug out."
"Boss Farrakh?" Derek expressed alarm.
"I thought there was an unwritten rule that species only fight an equivalent level of technology."
"It's more of a custom," Perkins replied with an angry look on her face. "Usually the Boss Farrakh send the Wargalin to fight the Ruhar or Torgala, while the Boss Farrakh reserve their own forces to tangle with the Jarraptha. Beating up on lower-tech species risks intervention by the higher-ups. Apparently this time the Boss Farrakh decided that stepping into this battle was worth the risk of the Rindaloo slapping them down."
"The Ruhar lost a cruiser," she reported with shock, having just seen that tactical update.
"A cruiser?" Dave asked, dismayed.
"The task force only had two cruisers, other than the old training ship."
"Does it say what happened to the other task force?"
Perkins shook her head, causing a lock of hair to swing down in front of her eyes. Dave's gaze followed the hair, mesmerized.
"The Star Carrier was supposed to pick them up first. We won't know their status until they jump in here. People, the toaster could be maneuvering soon. I expect us to be put on Grade 2 alert soon. Let's get our gear and come back here and—"
She was interrupted by a blaring alarm, announcing the ship was at alert condition too.
"Like I said."
They returned in less than 4 minutes, with everyone dressed in pressure suits and carrying a bag containing gloves, helmets, and extra life support packs. In battle, the humans did not have assigned action stations because the Ruhar did not want lowly aliens getting in the way. Perkins checked with the duty officer to see if she could report to the bridge and was told, politely but firmly, that she could best help the ship's operations by keeping away of Ruhar engaged in their jobs. Emily Perkins found that mildly insulting, as on the way back to the briefing room she saw young Ruhar cadets racing toward their duty stations. Even Nert was assigned to a damage control party amidships. She pinged him to ask if he was okay, and he replied only with a terse yes before cutting the connection. When Perkins got back to the briefing room, her entire team was there. Shauna was wearing a full spacesuit, having been in training when the alert sounded.
"Ma'am," Shauna looked up from helping Jesse attach his helmet.
"Any news?"
"Not much. The Ruhar were hit by a group of Wargalin ships, and the battle was going well enough. Then a Boss Farrakh cruiser jumped into the action. Our allies think the Boss Farrakh stepped in to help the Octopussies."
Excuse me, ma'am.
Octopussies?"
Jesse looked to his companions, who were equally confused.
"I've never met one, of course," Perkins explained.
"Like the Theranin, our info about other species comes mostly from the Ruhar. We know the Theranin look like little green men, right?"
Her team nodded, so she continued.
"Apparently the Wargalin are a sort of land octopus, so at HQ we call them Octopussies. The Boss Farrakh are worried about the weakness of the Wargalin, so they're assisting them directly. The Boss Farrakh think the Theranin did too little too late to help the Krestang, and now the Theranin themselves got beat badly, and the Krestang are useless to assist. The Boss Farrakh are determined not to let Wargalin weakness harm their ability to control territory."
Perkins lowered her voice and glanced toward the door to assure no Ruhar were listening.
"From the report," she tapped her tablet, "I get the feeling the Ruhar are very concerned about this development. If the patron species are going to step in directly against the hamsters, then our allies need to reconsider their ability to hold territory they recently took from the lizards."
"Hell, ma'am."
Jesse looked stricken.
"Does that include Paradise?"
"I don't—"
Perkins hesitated because that thought had not crossed her mind.
"I don't think so.
At least not now. The concern is about territory the lizards held until the Thurannan got their asses whipped by the Jirattha in the past couple years. The Ruhar thought they could just kick the tires and decide which planets they want to keep. Now it looks like the Jirattha may hold them back until the Beatles understand just how serious the Bosphorak are about defending their coalition's territory.
Colonel, Dave asked hopefully, does this apply only to territory near space controlled by the Bosphorak?
No, Perkins shook her head. The task force was far from Bosphorak space when they got jumped. This is something new. The Jirattha may now be fighting the Bosphorak about who controls territory the Thurannan lost.
Because the Bosphorak will give it back to the Thurannan once they rebuild their strength?
Shauna asked, though she thought she already knew the answer to that question.
No, Perkins snorted.
The Bosphorak and Thurannan hate each other more than they hate the Jirattha. This development is likely the result of the Bosphorak taking advantage of Thurannan weakness to cherry-pick star systems they want for themselves. My guess is the Jirattha will need to test the Bosphorak to see where they will push back. This has gotta be. She let out a long breath and swept her hair back before pulling her helmet over her head. Frustrating to the Jirattha.
Frustrating? They probably love this, Dave interjected. Not knowing what territory the Bosphorak might fight to hold is going to provide super juicy wagering action for the Jirattha. The Ruhar say those beetles will bet on anything. This has got to have them excited out of their minds.
You may be right about that, Dave. Perkins almost used his first name. Blushing inside her helmet, she corrected herself.
Chaika, we may find out when that star carrier returns.
Inwardly, she groaned when another thought struck her. While it was good to observe their allies in real action, the losses suffered by the task force very likely meant the training crews would be cut short before humans could fully qualify for space duty and demonstrate their ability to operate effectively alongside the hamsters. If the war in the sector was now entering a dangerous and unpredictable phase, opportunity for further training may be delayed significantly.
Hopefully it gets back here soon.
Irene zoomed the display image outward, expanding to show another ship that had jumped in 68 light seconds away and was now accelerating hard to form up with the others.
What are they like? Dave asked.
The Jirattha? Irene held up her hands.
We've never met them.
But you and Captain Bonsu have flown to their ship.
That was only to practice manual docking procedures, Irene explained. We flew into one of their docking bays, waited for the clamps to engage and release. Then we flew out, kind of like doing touch-and-goes with aircraft. There was a Jirattha who talked to us, but we never even saw one of the beetles. The gallery above the docking bay was empty. We were told the Jirattha are not unfriendly to lower species. The crew of the Star Carrier was just very busy with all the training going on.
Is their ship really called the Deal Me In? Jesse asked.
A cadet told me that, and I didn't know if he was playing a joke on me.
No joke, Irene assured the soldier. The name does translate as Deal Me In, or close enough.
You think the Beatles will really bet on what places the Bosphorak will defend? Jesse continued.
Derek answered the question.
From what I've heard, the Jirattha will bet on pretty much anything. What I wonder is whether their intel people base their assessments on wagering.
They would do that?
Shauna was shocked by such an idea.
Not based on their own bets, Derek explained. I meant based on what the overall Jirattha public is wagering on.
Yes, Perkins agreed with a nod toward Derek. That type of crowdsourced prediction model can often be more accurate than the assessments of so-called experts. When I was at the Pentagon, we were looking at using a prediction market system to forecast future threats.
Ma'am?
Jesse blinked.
What kind of market?
Market-based. Think of it like drafting a fantasy football team where you're using real money to buy players you think will perform well the next season. At the Pentagon, we experimented with a team of threat assessment people to project the next hotspot. We created a sort of market where people could buy binary options in various potential threat scenarios, with the value of a particular threat rising as the threat became more likely. And before you say it sounds like a crapshoot, Perkins gave a disarming smile at Jesse. That system predicted we would be in Nigeria 14 months before the president pulled the trigger to put boots on the ground there.
Holy crap, Jesse gasped. Come on, Cornpone, we were talking about us going into Nigeria way back when we were in boot camp, Dave reminded his friend.
Well, yeah, but I didn't think people were betting on it.
I know it sounds sketchy, Perkins said with sympathy. But the Giraptha might just be crowdsourcing their strategic intel using real money through a wagering system, she added with a faraway look on her face, the wheels turning in her head. As a former intelligence officer, she would love to know how accurate the Giraptha system was in real life.
It sounds crazy, Derek agreed, but it may work as well as any system we have.
I'll stick to fantasy sports, Jesse replied, chagrined.
Nobody gets killed.
If the Giraptha intel scopes out right, less people will get killed, Dave argued.
Prediction markets aren't perfect, Perkins admitted. To be useful, you need to filter out what people think will happen from what they think the popular opinion is. Too many times, people in the market try to guess what the herd is thinking rather than using their own gut.
The glazing eyes of her audience told Perkins she was getting way too nerdy on that subject.
Health agencies on Earth have been using predictive markets to project flu outbreaks for years, and they work pretty well. If we ever get an opportunity to talk with the Giraptha, I'll ask them about it.
Ha! Jesse laughed. They'll want to bet with you about what you think the answer is. Those beetles...
Irene interrupted him.
Star Carrier jumped in.
Damn, they really nailed that jump.
Exactly in the center of their target emergence point.
Her voice reflected the admiration she felt.
2.4 light seconds away. We should start moving.
An alarm blared and Irene smiled.
Like I said, we will start moving soon.
Within seconds, they felt a gentle tug to the right as the ship turned, then fired its engines. Irene watched the thrust indicator on the bottom of the display and was pleased that her guess, based on feel, matched what the display showed. The Rue to Stella was not moving quickly. As a non-combatant and not having suffered any battle damage, the training cruiser would be last in line to latch onto the Star Carrier. It hung back away from the cluster of warships approaching their assigned docking platforms, with the toaster providing an overall sensor view of the area and acting as a backup traffic controller to assist the Giraptha crew of the Star Carrier. Irene noticed something odd right away, and when she looked up to catch Perkins's eye, the colonel nodded with concern. She had seen it too.
Those ships are in a hurry, Irene said quietly. A big, goddamned hurry.
Looks like it, Perkins agreed.
Normal procedure for docking with the Giraptha Star Carrier was for ships to approach one at a time, remaining outside the imaginary bubble of space within which the Giraptha ship's AI took control from the docking ship's navigation system until the Star Carrier authorized them to proceed inward. Only when one ship was securely attached to a docking platform and powered down was a subsequent ship given clearance to approach. Due to the poor maneuverability of Star Carriers, the Giraptha were understandably worried about bulky armored warships clumsily crashing into each other, or into the vulnerable long spine of their space truck. What Perkins and Strebitch noticed was the Ruhar warships were approaching in groups of three, with the remaining two ships close behind. Though battle damage to the Ruhar ships rendered some of them awkward to handle, the Giraptha appeared to be more concerned about completing the docking operation as quickly as possible than about navigation safety. The two human women shared a look, and they both pulled their seat straps tighter.
People, Perkins ordered, let's get buttoned up.
She reached under the seat for her helmet.
I think once this ship gets moving for real, it could be a rough ride.
At the moment, their cruiser was proceeding toward the Star Carrier at a leisurely rate of acceleration, hanging back to give the battle-damaged warships clearance to maneuver onto the docking platforms.
What's up, Colonel? Jesse asked.
Irene answered for Perkins.
The Giraptha are breaking safe docking protocol. They're going for combat latching. That means incoming ships fly a partly independent approach, get onto whatever docking platform they can reach ASAP, and hold on with their own magnetic grapples as best they can.
The Beatles are worried about something. They want to jump out of here pronto.
They won't jump without us, will they?
Dave asked, hoping he knew the answer.
No, Derek assured the soldier.
Irene acted as the killjoy.
They won't if they can help it, but the Beatles aren't going to risk their Star Carrier and a dozen warships for a training cruiser. If they think they're in jeopardy, they'll jump away, and we'll be on our own. We'll be on our own for a short time.
Derek shot the other pilot a look. Chaika, all it means is if the Star Carrier jumps away, we jump away also and meet up at a pre-programmed AZ.
What if that AZ is hot also? Shauna asked.
Then we go to the alternate AZ, and then another. Look, Jared, Chaika, the Ruhar and Jirapatha have been doing this for a very long time.
Derek said it in a calm, steady voice.
Probably before humans had any form of writing. They know what they're doing. And, he added for emphasis, they've been kicking the lizards and Theranin's asses all over this sector.
Besides, Irene chimed in unhelpfully, we're just a training ship. In a battle, we would be the last ship targeted.
Yeah, because we're the most vulnerable, Shauna rolled her eyes at Irene.
Sorry, Irene muttered.
Just then, another alarm blared, and the ship's acceleration increased noticeably.
The Jirapatha wants us docked as soon as possible, too, she said as she watched the display project the ship's course, straight into a docking platform in the middle of the Star Carrier between two other ships.
The Jirapatha must be confident their undamaged ship could tuck into that tight space, Irene thought to herself, while they are directing the incoming battle-damaged warships onto platforms that had plenty of empty space around them.
Captain Strebich, Dave asked, pointing at the display. What's that destroyer doing?
A go-around, Irene guessed. She had watched the stricken destroyer approach its assigned platform clumsily. Clearly, that ship's damaged propulsion system was making it difficult to control its flight. The destroyer had fired its thrusters on full to avoid a collision with another incoming ship, overcorrected, and been forced to back away using its main engines.
The Jirapatha waved it off. It will have to try again.
What if they can't do it? Shauna asked, fearing for the crew of the destroyer.
They'll have three options, Derek explained. They can get tugbots to tow them in.
They won't have time for that, Irene said quietly. Those tugs are designed to move dropships, not starships.
Or they can remain stationary, and the Star Carrier can maneuver to latch them on.
I sure wouldn't want to do that, even if we weren't in a hurry.
Derek shook his head at the thought of the massive Star Carrier, burdened with warships, trying to perform the delicate operation of moving precisely enough to position a docking platform under the belly of the destroyer. Shauna unconsciously pulled her arms tightly around herself from anxiety.
What's the third option?
Abandon ship, Irene replied. Get the crew off in dropships, send the ship away on autopilot. They can recover the ship later, or set it to self-destruct.
That's not optimal, Perkins noted. They probably have wounded aboard. Moving them to dropships will take time and risk interrupting their medical treatment.
Yes, ma'am, Irene agreed in a soothing tone. The Ruhar have a procedure for that. I'm sure that ship's command crew began prepping their medical teams to transport the wounded as soon as they realized the ship wasn't responding properly to her helm.
I hope they did. Shauna clenched her fists as she spoke.
Look, Derek pointed. That destroyer is opening docking bay doors. They're preparing to abandon ship.
It was Emily Perkins' turn to clench her fists. If the Jirapatha were junking a destroyer after one failed docking attempt, the Beatles must be very concerned about getting away from the assembly zone as quickly as possible. That meant the Beatles expected trouble. And that was not good. Before she could halt her tongue, she muttered aloud,
I hope this doesn't turn into a fight. If we have to fight, this could get kinetic in a hurry, Irene warned.
Their cruiser was significantly behind the other ships in line for docking. Even with the toaster's command crew now twisting the cruiser's tail to get it moving faster, they would not be docking for over 20 minutes. Distances in space were vast, and the ship's approach speed was limited, because however hard they accelerated toward the Star Carrier, they would need to cancel their relative speed before docking.
Yeah, Derek grimaced. We throw that term around loosely, but remember out here, kinetic can be measured as a percentage of light speed. A fleck of paint could punch through the hull armor.
He rapped knuckles on a bulkhead. If it's going fast enough.
Captain?
Jesse did not like the mental image of being killed by a tiny fleck of paint.
You are a genuine confidence booster.
Despite the anxiety of the team's pilots, who could only watch the combat latching operation,
All the warships attached themselves, even the destroyer that had been waved off its first attempt to connect with a docking platform. The Rue Tostella was the last ship to contact a platform, and the clamps had barely engaged when the Star Carrier jumped.